thing about St. Thomas Aquinas living and being a priest in the 13th century, he is for the Catholic Church a sort of icon of what it means to be a faithful priest, a faithful theologian. Most of you, or many of you, have probably heard of his great work, the Summa Theologiae, which has 3,112 questions of theology, all thoroughly answered by him. And not only thoroughly answered, he actually understands and anticipates any objections to his answers, and he responds to those objections to his answers right there in the text. Okay, so 3,112. And that is just a small portion of what the man wrote in his life. At one point, he was working on commentaries on every book in the New Testament. At the same time, he was writing commentaries on every work of Aristotle. Okay, they say that there were times, this is all before the printing press, he would have 4 to 5 scribes working for him. And he would go down the line, and each one would be working on a different work of his. And he would dictate a paragraph of, say, the Summa, or the commentary on the Nicomachean Ethics, and then go to the next scribe and dictate a paragraph of the commentary on the Letter to the Hebrews. And on down the way, his mind worked so well that by the time he got back to the first scribe, who in the meantime had enough time to write out this paragraph, he knew exactly what the next paragraph he wanted to be in the text was. So he often was thinking 3 or 4, we think of channels or tracks, he was not a one-track mind, he was like a 4-track mind. And this is why he was so productive. It was, we believe, a charismatic grace. He was what we might say, what I like to call an observational theologian. He observed how we work, how we live as human beings. And knowing what he did, not only from revelation, from faith, he was also well-schooled in philosophy and reason, which in the 13th century still meant something. Right. So he knew well the philosophy of Plato, and of course, new on the scene in the 13th century to the Europeans was Aristotle, who had finally been translated from Greek into Latin, not by the Catholics or the Christians, but by the Muslims of the day. And so he was using Aristotle to explain some of the great mysteries of the faith and some of the great mysteries of being human. If he were alive today, I think much of his theories would still hold up. I think much of Aristotle's theories would still hold up. I'll mention some of those ways as I move forward today. The reason I titled this talk, More Than a Body, More Than a Soul, is because for St. Thomas, the human person is neither just a body and neither just a soul. And I think if he were alive today, he would notice in our own culture a sort of dualism, a sort of bipolar nature to how we think about ourselves, that so often we're focused on the beauty of the body. I had to be very careful when I Googled Victoria's Secret picture. Okay, we're very concerned about, I literally Google Victoria's Secret mall store. That's all I put in. We're very concerned about the beauty of the body, the health of the body. I think about, you know, all how emphatic we are about fitness. None of these things are evil or bad in themselves. All right, that's an important thing to state, especially being fit and working out. The question always for St. Thomas will be, is the intention and the motivation. Right. So we have that on one end of our sort of cultural spectrum. But then we have also a certain, among non-believers even, a certain focus on mindfulness and meditation, that I am not my body, that there's, a deeper me inside here. You know, we would call it a soul. People sometimes call it the mind. They call it their center, you know. So we do have these, beauty is only skin deep, right? These two sort of poles in our culture, right? St. Thomas would want to encourage us always to avoid any sort of dualism, that the body and soul are different things, different components of the same person, all right? He's once again living in a milieu that's used to Plato, who sort, and this is very much, I'm giving you tonight in 45 to 50 minutes would take me in more depth three lectures to do, so we're going to see how we can do this. So some of this is necessarily we're skimming the surface here. Plato, the soul is the motor of the body, right? If you all have studied Plato, it's sort of weighed down by the body. You know, the pre-existing soul is sort of taken and thrown into the body. Or most of us live in the sort of post-Cartesian world that's still influenced by this idea that the soul is the ghost in the machine. Even Catholics, well into the 20th century, Catholic piety sort of was influenced by the Cartesian milieu. So you often hear people sometimes refer to this mortal coil that I'm going to slough off, right? Or you can hear people, sometimes there's even in the early 20th century pious works that refer to Jesus Christ as wearing a suit of flesh, right? The suit of a body, which understood wrongly is actually a heresy. Okay. Gnosticism, the heresy through which Saint Dominic founded the Dominican order, this idea that the soul is what is the true me, it's the divine part of me, but this body is sort of an evil part of me. Now, some of this is latent in Christianity. If you think of Saint Paul, the spirit, the flesh struggling against the spirit. We live with a certain tension between soul and body, all of us. That's because of original sin, and we'll get to that. But for St. Thomas, the point to understand is that the body and the soul are not to be understood as two separate, reified things. Right? Two separate components, if you will. So even how we think about it. For St. Thomas, the relationship of body and soul is the relationship of matter and form. And here we get to his Aristotelianism. Matter here, remember, for Aristotle, if you remember, this is sort of new to you, that matter is, for Aristotle, pure potency. Think about the material you can make anything of. When Aristotle talks about it, you never see matter just walking down the street, right? It's never just sit there in a blob. It always is informed. It always has a shape, a purpose, what he would call the form. But abstractly, he would say matter is just the stuff that makes everything be what it is, or that we impress upon it to do what it's supposed to do. Right? It's the concrete, it's kind of a fancy word, but concrete instantiation. It's the stuff of concrete things, desks, tables, you. All right? The form is that which gives matter shape and function. The form, this is an important idea which we'll get to when we talk about the soul. The form contains and defines the matter. The obvious example that every philosophy professor to undergrad uses is something like Michelangelo's David, right? The matter here is marble, right? The form is this young man, David. Right? So the stuff and the form. Now, when we talk about the human person, for St. Thomas, the matter is the flesh, it's the body. And by the body, he doesn't mean simply physical appearance. He means everything that is physical about us, from our digestive system to our neurological system to our brains, to anything that can light up in the brain, from your memory to your imagination. All of that is part of the matter. Okay, all the cells, the DNA, all of that is part of matter. The form, what makes this matter you and makes it human, is, for St. Thomas, the soul. Right. Now, initially, right off the bat, you can see why this is so important for him. Because without the soul, you wouldn't have the stuff of a digestive system, of a muscular system, of a nervous system, of even how you look or how you feel, how you imagine, how your memory works. All of that, for St. Thomas, is the stuff, but it's only the stuff of a human person because it is all formed, shaped, however you want to think about that, by the soul. Okay. The soul, for St. Thomas, is the principle of life. In fact, that's what, in Latin, the word soul is anima, which is where we get our English word animate. The soul is what makes a thing animated, alive. And so for St. Thomas, the human person is not simply body or soul. The word he uses throughout his writing is compositum humanum. He's a human composite. We're a composite being. We're not angels. And when you die, you won't become angels, I'm sorry to tell you. We are human beings who are composite beings of matter and form, flesh and spirit. Another way he talks about it is we are embodied spirits. Our souls are such spiritual substances that God makes the soul, this form, to be part of this matter, to inform this matter and give it life. Now, there's a difficulty in translating. I know we're in a very, when I was on my way down here, I bumped into a friend on the plane, and he said, oh, you're going to speak at Carnegie Mellon. You know, they're big scientists down there. So I was going to admit that there is a difficulty in translating Aristotelian principles with modern science. But I do think there's a way to think about this. Okay? For Aristotle and for Aquinas, form is the principle of continuity. So the form guarantees coherence and unity of the material in a unified organism. So an Aristotelian, when we learn biology, what little we do, you know, because we're philosophers or theologians, and we start hearing about, for instance, proteins that cause or initiate cellular division, or proteins that cause epigenetic signatures for different cells. And we ask, well, why is that? What is doing that? The answer that St. Thomas would give, it's the soul. The soul is the sort of principle of organization for all of that. Right? Now, you can say, well, but we can look at these proteins and how they interact with that and this and this. And we would just simply take it, let's go back another step. Well, what causes that? For St. Thomas, everything about the material of the body, what keeps it organized together, is not simply a DNA blueprint. I'm translating into a modern idiom here. But in fact, the principle of life itself, which is the soul. And this is also the principle, I'm sure I can ask this question, you all will know it, because it's not on the top of my head. Given the cellular regeneration in the human body, how long is it, what's the sort of total amount of time between you being completely sort of having new cells?
7 years.
7 years, thank you, okay. The soul is the principle of life that keeps that continuity through those 7 years. So that you are always you, and your body is always your body. Right? So matter, for Aristotle and for St. Thomas, these citations here are citations in the Summa. That's the Summa Theologiae, the first part, question 76, article 5. Matter exists for the sake of the form, which is the principle of life. All right. So the body exists for the sake of the soul. The body would not be what it is if it were not the soul. It would be a corpse if it weren't for the soul. It would be just a lump of flesh. Okay. It's the soul that guarantees, as cells divide, as a baby grows, that this is all organized so that the same person who is the infant with that huge head, all right, becomes the Dominican friar, right? So you can tell I'm already thinking of that picture, right? Basically, what are you doing? Get me out of this thing. Okay, so that it's the same person throughout all the material changes. The soul is the principle of continuity. The human composite. So on the soul side, for St. Thomas, the soul by its very being is united to the body as form. That's an important statement by him. He means that the soul is such a being, such a substance, that it's made to be united to the body. It doesn't have a meaning when it's not in the body. Right? The soul needs the body for knowledge, for movement. Get into this more. All knowledge for St. Thomas, like Aristotle, begins in the senses. Right? So he obviously knows not only about the five exterior senses. He has interior senses too. He calls it the imagination, the common sense. He doesn't mean, you know, when we say people don't have common sense. He means, you know, your body takes in the data from the five exterior senses, but that the common sense, which now today I'm sure we know which part of the brain does this, that the common sense is able to unite the data from not only how things touch or feel, but what they look like, so that the mind can know that this lamp not only looks this way, but it has this particular texture, right? He thinks that's all in the body. That's not the soul. That's all flesh. That's all material. Following me? And then the estimative cognitive, we can get into at some point. That's basically instinct in animals. He thinks animals have all of these, right? Animals have memory. Animals have imagination. Anyone who has seen a dog trying to run in its sleep knows that the animal has imagination, right? So he would not be surprised by today's developments when we hook people up to brain scans and try and show them pictures of loved ones, that certain parts of the brain light up. St. Thomas would say, of course it does. That's the memorative. That's the body. It's the brain. Okay, so he doesn't think the brain is the place of the soul. The soul is the organization of all systems in the body, all cells in the body, everything. Okay, but the soul's activities, although they start in the body, they transcend the body. Let me give you an example. For St. Thomas, like Aristotle, everything that we know, whenever you're thinking about anything, you're using the imaginative and the memorative, along with your senses. Right? You cannot think of even the most abstract theoretical thoughts, like Pythagorean theorem, or ideas about love, ideas about freedom, ideas about God, without having an image in your head. Right? This is why Catholics, when we start hearing about spiritualities that start with the phrase, center yourself and clear your mind, we say it's impossible. It's literally impossible to have a blank mind. Someone tells you you have a blank mind, what do? You think of a brick wall, a white wall. That's an image. Your mind is not blank. All right? We are creatures who cannot learn without imagery that our brain, the material, produces for the soul to do its thing. But the soul can take that material, freedom and love, memories of experiences of affection, and can make the jump to universal knowledge and truths, like the universal truth of love and freedom and God and responsibility and rights and duties, all of those things. That's not, Aquinas would dismiss with prejudice, as would I, any sort of materialist that's simply neurons and synapses firing in the brain, that there's something spiritual about that. It's natural for the soul, St. Thomas says, to understand by turning to the phantasms, which is what he means by those images in the head. We cannot understand anything without the body doing that for the soul. Right? Otherwise, and this is his point, not mine, otherwise the body would only need the soul for living. And then we're kind of back to Gnosticism, right? We're kind of back to a dualism. The body and the soul need each other. So the body needs the soul as the principle of life. The soul needs the body in order to learn and also to express itself. This theory, and I don't have it up here, for St. Thomas is called hylomorphism. The body and soul together need each other, are sort of intertwined and enmeshed just as much as matter and form is intertwined and enmeshed in Michelangelo's David. He is so strong on this point that in his treatise on angels, because he believes in angels as a good Christian, you know, they're in the scriptures, he thinks that angels, the question is always what the power of angels, right? He thinks that angels, no angel, no person can read your heart. Only God can do that. Only God can read the heart. But that angelic creatures are infinitely smarter than you and I are. And they read your body. They read all the nonverbals. Right? And we all know people who can read nonverbals well. It looks, feels like they're reading your mind. Right? Angels, St. Thomas argues, can do that only to infinitely better than you and I can. Which is kind of terrifying. Right? But they can't know your soul, your heart. And only in as much as the soul, whatever's going on in your soul, is basically painted on your body. It's there. That's how enmeshed it is. He's so strong on this that he says that when you die and the soul separates from the body and, God willing, ends up in the beatific vision, until the general resurrection of the dead, and here he's different than Aristotle, until the general resurrection of the dead, he thinks that the soul is not naturally itself. Even though it's looking at God, because God made that soul for your body. Right? Now, having the beatific vision more than makes up for this. He basically says this, right? But that's why the general resurrection of the dead is such an important Christian truth. So that you get a glorified body. And he says that the glorified body is glorified not only before it reunites with the beatified soul, because it needs to be, otherwise it wouldn't be able to handle a beatified soul, but also that what's going on in the soul looking at God is so glorious that it flows over into the body in a beautiful way. He has, during Q&A you can ask me this, he has a great thought on this, on the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Mother and what her grace of her soul actually did to her body while she was going through her life. All right. Now, the important thing to note about matter and form and about the spiritual world and the physical world is not so much the hierarchy of being, although we should sort of pay attention to the hierarchy of being. You know, nothingness, inanimate matter, plants, animals, human, angels, right? You can sort of see that there's a... that these are the material things in God's creation. Angels have no material, they're pure spirits. So they're pure intellectual spirits. St. Thomas thinks animals and plants do have souls, just as Aristotle did, because they're alive. He doesn't think they're immortal souls, right? So the Thomist is going to tell you your dog isn't going to heaven, right? We'll talk about that during the Q&A. Where's God in this? For St. Thomas, because of how he perceives, and this is sort of an extension of his understanding of matter and form, his understanding of existence and essence, and that God is existence itself. And that's really what it is for St. Thomas. God is existence. Anything that exists, exists by participating in God's existence. He is the very act of existing. All right? So for St. Thomas, it's incredibly misguided and somewhat heretical when you draw your hierarchy of being to want to put God at the top up here, as though he's just at the top of the ladder. And it's wrong for St. Thomas to call God the supreme being, because it makes it seem as though God is just the best of all the other beings. He's being itself. Right? And so God is not the one at the top of the ladder. He's sort of holding the ladder up. The ladder exists in him. He's participating in his existence. Right? The same is true for matter and form, for the soul and the body. We tend to think, because we're all living in a post-Cartesian world, that the soul is in the body. For Aquinas, this is not the case. It's rather that the body is in the soul. Although corporeal things are said to be in another as in that which contains them, a cube of ice and a cup of and a glass, nevertheless spiritual things contain those things in which they are, as the soul contains the body. Hence also God is in things as containing them. So God contains everything because he is existence. Everything that exists exists by participation in him. Hence also God is in things as containing them, nevertheless by a certain similitude To corporeal things, it is said that all things are in God, inasmuch as they are contained in him. And then later, this is all in the first part, the prima pars. Rather does the soul contain the body and make it one than the reverse. We got to get over thinking that the soul is the captain up in my brain operating the machine. The body is in the soul just as the matter of the marble is in the form of David. Look at how we speak about it. We would never say the form is in the matter. We would never say David is in the marble, would we? We'd say the marble is in the form of David. The body is in the form of the soul. Right? So this is why, like, even the phrase beauty is skin deep, for St. Thomas and for all the medieval sort of scholastics, the body reveals, everybody's body reveals something about them and about their souls. Right? This is why even, and we all naturally act this way. Right? I mean, no matter how much we want to believe that how we present ourselves shouldn't matter and doesn't matter, we all know it does. Right? It's the story of St. Ignatius of Loyola, founder of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, who, out of sort of devotion to the poor Christ, stopped showering and shaving. The Blessed Mother appeared to him to tell him to take a shower because nobody wanted to be around him to hear the gospel proclaimed. We all know this is the case. The material exists in the spiritual. Now, because we are both matter and rational spirit or intellectual spirit, we are sort of bridging these two different parts of creation, the rational with the material. It means that as a human person, we have in us something of the material, of animals and plants, digestive systems, passions and emotions. So for St. Thomas, you know, this would be a whole class just on the passions if we were going to do this. But for St. Thomas, he says the passions are part of the material in us, intimately united to the soul, but it's our passions that are part of the body. This is why your body, he always says there's a change in your body whenever you experience a passion, right? You know, your face turns red, you tear up, you know. There's always a change. Your heart races, right? Your palms sweat. There's always changes in the body. And that may happen because somebody's come in the room who you have a crush on, or it may happen because your memory has triggered a painful memory of a loved one who's died, and you, using your free will and the soul, have chosen to engage that memory and to work with it and to think about it, and that can drum up passions. See, unlike dogs, they have no control of their passions. They have these same passions. They have no control of them, right? That's why you can't blame the dog for doing what it shouldn't do. You can discipline the dog, but you can't say it's morally guilty of something, right? So for St. Thomas, he has 11 emotions. I'm just going to say these really quite quickly. He says we have basically two drives, emotional drives in us. Once again, part of the body, cupiscible, which are the emotions that flare up with desire of goods. When we see things we want, or people we want, or evils that we want to avoid, things we want to avoid. These are the emotions, and they're always opposites. So love and hatred, right? Desire and aversion. Joy and sorrow and sadness, right? The irascible, and you all probably know what this term means. When you talk about someone who's irascible, what are you talking about? Someone who's kind of always, you know, getting worked up, always ready to fight the crusade, always ready to fight the bad. These are irascible people, right? Some people say I'm an irascible person. If anyone follows me on Twitter, you probably know this. So, the irascible. Now, some of these words use the love and hope. You know, these are emotions, but they also obviously have other uses in his work. Hope and despair. The irascible, these emotions are the emotions that flare up when you're expecting difficulty. When there's a good that you desire, but it's going to be difficult to achieve, to get to, or an evil is going to be difficult to avoid. I mean, in some ways, it's your irascible hope that suggests you can even get a college degree, because it's a difficult thing to achieve. Now, you may not think it's, some of you may think it's more difficult than others, right? But that's your irascible. I can do this. When you sort of psych yourself out, that's the irascible working out. Fear. And its opposite, daring. And then the last one doesn't have an opposite, because they all sort of culminate in the last and final irascible emotion, which, of course, is anger. You know, to get angry at the good that's difficult to achieve, to get angry because you can't write the paper, you can't find the idea, to get angry at the professor. This doesn't happen here, right? You know, who won't approve the topic that you want to write on. This is the irascible. Now, here's the thing for St. Thomas on this. This is all part of the body. In the 13th century, and even before, but in the 13th century, the heresy that was sort of going around, the Albigensianism, was basically Gnostic, and said that anything in the body was evil. And so that the Christian, they said, is someone who doesn't feel emotions. Because the emotions are a part of the body and they will take you away. They will carry you away. You have to be rational and logical. Pope Francis often talks about this in a certain, in his own way, right? When you meet Christians who are just all logic and don't seem to want to feel anything, this is not Christianity. This is not St. Thomas. Okay? For St. Thomas, the passions are neutral in themselves. It's not morally good or evil to feel things, but... And this is what Sesame Street taught, well, my generation, maybe Barney taught you, I don't know. It's what you do with the emotions, right? It's what you allow them to do for you. They become moral when they become voluntary, which is to say when you start to act on them. And sometimes the emotions can help you do things better, do good things better, and sometimes they can help you do evil things even worse, right? They're not offenses or disturbances, even though we often feel that they are. And that's because of original sin, except when they're out of control and when we sort of let them go out of control. That's when they become offensive. Passions are part of the perfection of man because we are the human composite. Now, when he talks about love... This is where we're moving into just a different section on the human person here. For St. Thomas, love is not just an emotion, it's a drive. And anyone who's ever been in love knows this. Right? Love for St. Thomas begins from the fact that everything that is, whether it's an electron, a goose, a tree, a flower, you or me, everything that exists has a purpose. I don't mean some sort of, you know, divine purpose and like I gotta find my vocation in life. I mean, electrons don't have vocations, right? What he means by this is that everything that exists, the form, its form, has a goal. Electrons, they rotate around protons and neutrons. That's their goal. That's what they do. All right. St. Thomas uses the term. That's connatural. Trees grow towards the sun. That's what they do. Right? Geese fly south. That's their connatural end. That's what's suitable to them. He says love is the drive or the principle of movement to that which is connatural, to that which is the end. Right? So in a certain way, he would say an electron has an appetite. The electron... equivocating on the word love here, but an electron loves to rotate around protons and neutrons. All right? Geese love to fly south. Trees love to grow towards the sun. Rocks love to be on the ground. You want to know how I know that? Because if I take a rock and I drop it, where does it go? Straight to the ground. It loves being on the ground. Now you can say, well, there's gravity. And St. Thomas will say, yeah, I know, that's what gravity does. It's the inclination of the rock to be on the ground, right? You can analyze those fields however you want, but that's its love. The rock loves to be on the ground. The sensitive appetite are the passions that dogs, animals, and you and I have. You know, this is your, you know, you all seem to have loved that pizza pretty well, right? That's the love of the emotions we were just talking about. But human love, truly human love, body and soul, is something very unique for St. Thomas. And he has a special word for it, dilexio. It's the love of choice. That the human person, composite of body and soul, passions working up to attractions, can in fact choose what he or she is going to love. And many loves, not just the love of your life, which is a very good thing to figure out, right? But what field of study you want, you love, what food you love, even down to Coke versus Dr. Pepper. For St. Thomas, all of these are moral choices. It is a moral choice whether you're drinking Coke or Dr. Pepper. The human person makes these choices through a whole series at St. Thomas we don't have time to go into of how the intellect and your choice works, your will works, but with the influence of passions, memories, imagination, all of this is at work in the human person. Because the good for St. Thomas, when he uses the word good, he means anything that is desirable, that's a good. That which is desirable is that which actualizes or a capacity or a potential. That pizza was good for you because you needed your stomach actualized. Right? This is the Jerry Maguire line, "You complete me." He's doing Thomas. Right? She actualizes him. All right. She actualizes his potential. But in order to truly actualize another agent, whatever you love actually has to have the property or the quality that you think is going to actualize you. This is why people date, to figure out if this person actually has the qualities that you think are going to fulfill you. Right? And then love actually moves to different stages. But, you know, when obviously you break up, you realize, yeah, they weren't really the person I thought they were. Right? Or it's always something, good person, potencies and actualizations. I'm sure this is exactly how you think of it. we're not really aligned. Right? Man, for St. Thomas, is an intellectual, irrational animal. And so the soul, this intellect, it's good. Its love is truth. It loves to pursue truth. And the will, he says, its love is to pursue goodness, which is all the things that are actualized. They work together. Sometimes they make mistakes. Sometimes you pursue things you think are good that turn out not to be good. Sometimes they're not as good as you thought they were. Sometimes they're downright evil, but you pursued them because you're addicted, because your passions are out of control, because you've created a certain vice by making bad decisions over and over again. And so now you can't even tell what is good or evil, right, in particular things. This is all St. Thomas's theory on how human behavior works. The will, he calls it a rational appetite. It sort of works with the mind and the intellect to sort of figure out what our choices make. Every choice we make is always an intellectual choice. Even when we think we're being stupid and just vegging out on the couch, that was an intellectual choice. Your dog didn't make an intellectual choice. It just did it because you're doing it. Right? Now, for St. Thomas, and this is what I always say when I teach my students, the whole point of all of this is about understanding what it means to be human and what it means to be moral. And we sort of tend to look at morality as a set of rules and obligations. But in the Summa Theologiae, the center section, the second part, there's the first part, second part, and third part. And the second part is actually broken into two parts. So it's the first part of the second part and the second part of the second part. Right? The center section is all about the morality. And the first question is not at all, what must I do? What am I obligated to do to be moral? The first question is, what does it mean to be happy? What does it mean to be fully human? Right? So for St. Thomas, morality is about two things. What is happiness and how do I get it? That's what his whole method is. And he says happiness, because we are human, our highest power is what makes us what we are. It's not the digestive system. We share that with plants and animals. It's not the nervous system. We share that with animals. It's the highest power of the intellect. And for him, we use our knowledge just to know things for the sake of knowing things. So that happiness must require some sort of speculative knowledge, finding out what it is and what it isn't. What's going to fulfill our pursuit of truth and knowledge and learning how to achieve it. That's all speculative. I can give you an example of the speculative. All of you, you know, we parked in some parking garage, Thomas, way on the other side. What's the name of that parking garage? Anyone know?
It's the East Campus garage.
There's a horrible hike over here. I have no idea how this campus is laid out. All right? You do. That's speculative knowledge. All right? That's knowledge for its own sake. So when St. Thomas and Aristotle talk about speculative knowledge, they don't mean necessarily thinking about higher things like the meaning of life. They simply mean having knowledge for its own sake. Right? How an elevator works, or you know how the floor plan of this building that you've learned from doing this all this time. That's speculative knowledge. Practical knowledge for St. Thomas is the knowledge we use in action. So you got the floor plan, you got the campus map. When you sit there and figure out the route you're going to take to get to the dining hall and then get back to the library, that's practical. You can't do that without the speculative. I could not tell you the route to get you to the dining hall from here because I don't have the speculative. All right. So putting knowledge to use in our choices. We're pursuing happiness. For St. Thomas, happiness means nothing more than full human flourishing, that everything that we are is fully actualized, everything to the full, perfected to the full. That's happiness for St. Thomas. For Aristotle, it was nothing more than just being a reasonable person and making good choices. But St. Thomas has faith. It's been revealed to him, Jesus Christ. And what Christ has come to give us, how we were created. So for St. Thomas, happiness is nothing short of being united to God. And why is that? Because for St. Thomas, God is the supreme being, or he is supreme act. He's fully perfect. He is being itself. He is goodness itself. He's truth itself. He is all perfections. Any good, any truth, anything perfect that you love in this world, remember where he's sort of holding the whole thing up, it's only because it participates in him. The analogy St. Thomas uses is the pot on the fire. The heat of the pot is not the pots. It's the fires. It's participating in that heat. You following me? For St. Thomas, everything that is beautiful, everything that is true, everything that is good, including your dog, right, is so because it's participating in God's beauty and truth and goodness, which is why the Dominican says it doesn't matter if your dog's not there, because everything good and lovely you love about your dog will be present in God in a clear and infinitely better way. Infinitely better way. So God is the one we're seeking. Building off of St. Paul, this famous line from St. Paul's letter to the Romans, that God is visible, his invisible power is manifest in his creation. For St. Thomas, everything that God is, we can't see him in this life because he is perfect, he's infinite, he's the principle of existence, but we can see his effects, the fact that things exist. Revelation, the covenant with Israel, crossing the Red Sea, the incarnation of Jesus Christ. For St. Thomas, that's just more effects. He thinks we're all little scientists. Like, we see effects, and what does a scientist want to do? To know the cause, right? For St. Thomas, that's why he thinks we are only satisfied when we know God in himself. Because our minds will never stop seeking the cause of everything. Whether you're Stephen Hawking looking for the multiverse or the singularities or the perfect model, Stephen Hawking would never be satisfied until he knew exactly how this happened. St. Thomas says that's true for all of us. And that we would be frustrated if this was something we could not get. I'm going to come to a conclusion here in a bit. See, here's the thing. You can't. You cannot, and neither can I, come to know God perfectly in this life. And because he is existence itself and infinite and perfect, you cannot hope to achieve or to climb your way to him, because the gap between him and us is infinite. And you cannot, as any good philosopher or logician will tell you, traverse an infinite distance. All right? And so, for St. Thomas, and this is where grace comes in, when he looks at the Garden of Eden and how Adam and Eve were created, following the thoughts of St. Augustine, we were never, ever, as a species, ever intended by God. I mean, even that's a little, because he obviously knows what was going to happen with Adam and Eve. But God's sort of preeminent plan was that we never would have existed as a species without being in relationship with him, without having his grace. Because it's only by his grace that we can hope to come to know him as he is. This is what he always intended from the moment he created us. The Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden, was not simply a test. It wasn't a test. It's how he created us, with free will to choose. And he knew that they would fall. And he knew what he was going to do about it. So that in that state of perfect existence in Eden, and this is here, St. Thomas is not unique. I mean, this is Augustine. This is a lot of the church fathers. That Adam and Eve, their minds were with God. Their bodies were completely obedient to their souls. They never had emotions carry them away. They were just, can you imagine that? Like, they never had cravings that they would not want, that they didn't choose to have. They never had a growling stomach. There would be no arthritis, no crickety bones, no acne, nothing, right? None of that. And this was a supernatural grace. That's how he created us, to be in his grace. And it was the fall that sort of discombobulated everything and made it such that we're sort of left to ourselves. T.C. O'Brien is a sort of a famous American Dominican from the mid-20th century. Says that after the fall, because it was God's grace that kept us in line, kept everything like working perfectly in union with him, soul united to him, body united to the soul, that once we turned on God, all of that sort of falls apart. And so now we're all, to use a term, discombobulated. We're sort of left to ourselves. This is why we flit around life looking for happiness and trying to figure life out. And this has real effects, not just on the soul and our relationship with God, but it has real effects on our bodies and what our bodies and how our souls operate. This is why St. Paul says the soul, the body lusts against the soul or works against the soul. It's because the soul's powers itself, while they're neither destroyed or diminished, their inclination to perfection is now, there's an obstacle. We don't even know what it means to think well anymore, or to choose well anymore, or to love well. All of that would not need to have been taught if we were all living in grace with God. It would simply be who we were, what kind of species we would be. All right, that gift of original justice, that harmony destroyed by original sin. So now we have all of these obstacles, and we have all these conflicting goals in life. That's all original sin, and that's why we now need the healing grace of Jesus Christ. Simply say, to bring this to a conclusion on this, that this is why, for St. Thomas, the grace of the sacraments, confession, the Eucharist, the grace given to us through the suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ is efficacious not only in forgiving us the sinfulness against God, but actually working in us to slowly transform us and actually help us to grow in virtue and being good people, actually good human beings, not simply good believers, although being good believers is a very good thing, right? Here's the thing, body and soul. In this life, when you read St. Paul's letters, you'll see he talks about the mind all the time, turning your mind to God. Aquinas says that in this life, grace only works in the soul. It doesn't work in the body. Precisely because there's this alienation between body and soul caused by sin. This is why even after you're baptized, you have grace. You have faith, hope, and charity, and the infused virtues. But you're still going to grow old. And you're still going to get arthritis. And you're still going to have to deal with all sorts of bodily temptations. This is why St. Thomas says, in this life, you can get over mortal sin. Mortal sin, you know, remember, has to be serious. You have to know it's wrong and you have to freely choose it. That all means it's really thought out. You're doing it. St. Thomas says, when you're living in grace, you should be able to get over that. Because that's all that is stuff working in the mind, and that's exactly where the grace works. But you can never get over venial sin. Right? Remember, venial sin is a sort of a lighter sin. He says it's because venial sin is, you're just sort of off, your targeting is off. Because you're a little bent over. Right? So that, the good news, you can get over mortal sin. The bad news, you can't get over venial sin. So that in this life with the body, grace working in the soul, the spiritual life for St. Thomas is level one is getting over mortal sin. And then you begin to work on the venial sins by going to regular confession, you know, picking up these little things you are attached to, grudges you hold, you know, addictions, things that you're sort of left doing. He has this thing, so when you, and they just always keep, they're always going to keep coming up. You'll never be done with that project. He says, you know, for instance, you know, you work on gluttony and you have success on gluttony, and before you know it, vainglory pops up precisely because you're like, look, I'm no longer gluttonous. Well, yeah, okay, great, but now you're vainglorious. Right? So I said, spiritual life for St. Thomas is like playing a long spiritual game of whack-a-mole. Right? So that where the body is presenting difficulties and temptations and cravings, and in your spiritual life, you're always sort of whacking that down. Why? Because it's bad to have a craving for chocolate cake while you're in the middle of Mass? No. Because it's a sin? No. But because when you're in the middle of Mass or doing something that's higher, of a higher purpose, like studying, it's not a welcome craving. And coming to understand all of that. So that's St. Thomas on the human person. That was quite a bit. Thanks for your patience. I guess I'd take some questions. We have time for questions? Yeah. Questions? Yes.
Well, thank you first, Father. Thank you so much. My question is concerning the fall of man.
Yeah.
I'm having trouble understanding, was there an alternative possibility for Adam and Eve's actions?
Well, for them, yes, but for God, I mean, God always knew what they were going to do, right? And he had a sort of, St. Thomas would distinguish, and certainly later Thomas would distinguish between God's sort of, what we might call, so here's the thing about God, what we think, right? Is that not only does he know everything that happens, everything that has happened, everything that is happening, everything that will happen all at once. He knows because he lives in an eternal present. He knows everything that could have happened, everything that might happen, everything that possibly could happen. All right? So this is his infinite mind. So yes, in theory, there are all sorts of other possibilities. Yes. But St. Thomas would not, when he starts talking about, like, the example, for there was a great theological question in the 13th century between the Franciscans and the Dominicans. Would Jesus Christ, would the Son of God, have become incarnate if we had not sinned? Right? Because we say Christ came and was incarnate because of sin. The Easter Vigil, we sing the Exalted, we call it the Happy Fault, the Felix Culpa. Right? Oh, Happy Fault, which won for us so great a Redeemer. But if the whole point of the Incarnation is in fact to give us grace to unite us to God in the beatific vision, which even Adam and Eve did not have, but they would have, presumably they would have received that at some point. Does that mean God, of his own sort of predisposition and will to bring us into union with him, mean that regardless if there had been a sin, he still would have become incarnate, becoming one like us? Okay. A lot of fascinating arguments on both sides of that. St. Thomas, when he gets to that question, he says, it's kind of worthless to ask the question because it's not what happened. We should always build our theological arguments about what happened and what Scripture tells us and what reality tells us. Yes, sir. Then up to you.
I understand your correlation of anima, that which gives the body life, almost in medical terms.
Mm-hmm.
Almost saying homeostasis.
Yeah.
The body. And then you talked about the neurons. I always correlated anima with psyche, and both being one, psychology, study of the mind. And I almost...
I think Aquinas would say, like, the study of the... Because he would say the mind, I think in contemporary terms, what we call the mind, St. Thomas would say is the interaction of body and soul, by which, I mean... We would say, something get ready to blow up over there. He would say, because the mind, I mean, imagination, memory, that's all physical for him.
And kinetics and depth perception.
Yeah, all of that's physical. Yeah, for him. Yeah. See, that's where he's not going to, see, even so, even our common parlance of separating mind and body, he would be very uncomfortable with, because he thinks the mind, I mean, if he were alive today, I think he'd say what we're calling the mind is in fact the focal point of where the body and soul are actually interacting. You know,
I just interpreted it as the soul almost being the mind.
Yeah, so I think that's, and for St. Thomas that's clearly not the case, nor is it for Aristotle, because he would say that, because he has this whole thing about whether the soul, for instance, is simply the principle of one of our operations. So is it the principle of brain, what we might call brain activity? And he says no, because then you're going to say, well, what's the principle of sight? Or what's the principle of hearing? What's that principle? And then before you know it, you're talking about multiple souls. So that's why he settles with Aristotle that the soul is the principle of life of the whole organism, and the principle of life that keeps everything coherent and organized.
Okay.
You had a question for you.
How would Thomas Aquinas perform a Turing test on a machine?
My initial assumption would be...
Speculate.
I think he would... I'm not sure he would buy the parameters of the question that if a machine could do certain things, it demonstrates intelligence. I don't think he would accept that premise, because I think he would want to argue that intelligence is more than simply process analysis and A plus B just to get to, you know what I mean? So
could his soul inhabit a silicon chip?
Yeah, I don't think he would say. I think in his system, absolutely not. So all the sci-fi things about, you know, transferring consciousness to robots or computers, I mean, for St. Thomas, that's simply not possible. Now, theoretically or speculatively, if we get to a point where you're transferring memories and imagination, I mean, I think maybe that could be possible in his system, because he thinks all of that's material, right? But as far as, like, that... whatever that thing is, being the soul, it's not, because it's not a principle of life. But also, I think he would... it'd be interesting to see if such a thing, and we're really in the theoretical here, could actually make abstract, universal conclusions and not, you know, now have universal knowledge. Yes?
Talk about how angels are fully spiritual beings, but they can't see the human soul.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking in terms of angels and demons.
Yeah, they're for him, he's talking the same creature.
Absolutely.
Right,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally, yeah. Just how then do they act on the composite human for good or for ill? On the soul, on the body, on, you know.
Right. And so all of this, none of this is dogma, of course. I should say that. I just happen to think St. Thomas has all this figured out and his system fits together very nicely. So for St. Thomas, even looking at scriptural evidence, when we see how angels do things like the burning bush, or, you know, that angels, angelic creatures, seem to be able to impact the physical world, St. Thomas says that that's what angels can do. They can impact the physical world. So what they can do to you, when we talk about possessions or things like that, but not even just possessions, and this could get a little... you might not want to hear all this. That angels can impact the body side of you, but not the soul side of you. But because they're enmeshed, it's very hard to separate. So for instance, angelic creatures can impinge on your imagination and on your memory, right? So the devil made me do it. No, but perhaps a demonic or an evil sort of angelic presence, spiritual presence, keeps bringing that thought up in your memory that you don't like or that causes you to do things, right?
So the angelic, they can't compel the soul.
They cannot compel, but they can sort of pressure by using imagination and memory, which is why I always, you know, so like even in the scriptures, I mean, or when you see, when you have stories of people seeing things in the spiritual world, that's just imagination and memory being compelled by that angelic creature, right? That's why I always tell people, if you have that experience, you say, you know, you guys need to, if you don't know it, you need to say the St. Michael the Archangel prayer. You know, get that out of the, also the name of Jesus is very important. Here's the good news, the flip side of that, is that St. Thomas has a strong theology of guardian angels. And he thinks, he doesn't think that any of the thoughts you have, this is how strong he is on the relationship of grace to us when we're living in grace. He doesn't think any of your thoughts to do good. Augustine thinks the same thing. Like to your thought to pray, just maybe stop in the chapel and pray, your thought to forgive somebody even though you really don't want to. He doesn't think that comes from nowhere, that you just sort of drummed that up. He thinks that's a direct cooperation with God, that God is actually working in you to drum that up. But God, in St. Thomas's system, very seldom works directly and immediately. He often uses what St. Thomas calls secondary causes. It's like other people in your life. But he says this is the role of the guardian angel. So that when you have this thought, I should pray about that. That's your guardian angel. And then he's later going to say that the gifts of the Spirit, like wisdom and counsel and understanding, he says those are the gifts that we receive in the Spirit so that we become more and more docile and receptive to those little inspirations. So that part of growing in the spiritual life is simply paying attention to those inspirations. Like you wonder how you grow in holiness. It's not by doing grand things. It's by when you have, and we all have them when we're living with Jesus Christ. When you have that thought, stop in the chapel. Say a rosary. And we all get a lot of these every day. And how often do we say, I don't have time for that? But every time you do that, that was an invitation from your guardian angel communicating your, you know, through the direct causality of God for St. Thomas's and St. Thomas's view. It's a beautiful thing. I'll come to you. Yeah, yes.
I was wondering if you could comment on if there's any uneasiness here between like Aristotelian philosophy and Christian revelation as it relates to the human person. Because this whole picture, you know, deriving from Aristotle, would say that the magnanimous man is sort of the one to be, you know, cherished, and that what I love about you is your virtue.
Yeah.
Maybe Christian revelation sort of shows us through Trinitarian theology that there's something irreducibly other about you that I endlessly draw into, and that the ethics then become a little different.
Right. So this is where I think St. Thomas, so the theology of personhood or the philosophy of personhood is very undeveloped in St. Thomas. So it's I think it's anachronistic to try to push that onto him. This is where I think the theology of St. John Paul II, of the theology of the body, and this is what my book tries to do, is to show how St. John Paul II takes Thomas and sort of updates him, if you will, with this personalistic norm that there is something fundamentally other that has to be respected. And I think that is seminal. I think there are salient ways where St. Thomas is getting to that. He just never articulates it in that way.